Edwige Dantecat's first foray into nonfiction, Brother, I'm Dying, tells the twin narratives of her uncle and father's fascinating but quite difficult lives and deaths, in contrast to the story of her pregnancy. The memoirs received overwhelmingly positive reviews. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Edwige Dantecat back to the show today. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
When you first thought of writing these stories, did you consider doing it as fiction, as a novel?
Never. I just never thought that it would work that way, because it's writing it was, for me, a way of better understanding all these different things that were happening at the same time. It was a way of processing, and also the desire to document these things was so compelling that I thought this nonfiction would be the only way to tell it.
So you became a journalist instead of an inventor of stories. But was the writing process the same?
It was different, because I actually, what started me down the path was when, after my uncle died in immigration custody, we were given a piece of paper, which was his interview with the customs officer. And that sent me on a search for other documents. And so it was a kind of, you know, in Creole we'd say a fouillé, you know, a digging that led to the writing of it itself.
Well, the New York Times reported recently that 62 immigrants have died in U.S. administrative custody since 2004. Have you been following up on that story?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was interesting reading. I read that article just nodding my head the whole time, comparing our experiences with those of these families. You know, first of all, the experience of not knowing what happened to a loved one. You know, you're just given some, you know, you're given a corpse, basically. And the idea of, you know, the exchange medications and medications not given and all that. So that, all of that was very familiar. The experiences were very familiar.
Well, Joseph wasn't just an uncle. He was the person who brought you up for much of your childhood.
Mm-hmm. He was like a second father to me. My father had left Haiti for the United States when I was 2 years old. And my mother soon followed, and I spent most of my childhood with my uncle Joseph and my aunt.
He was a Pentecostal minister. Aren't most Haitians Catholics?
He was a Baptist minister. A lot of Haitians are Catholic, but there are also a lot of Haitians who are Protestant and some Haitians who practice Vodou. So it's we're not religiously monolithic.
He presided over funerals at his church, and he insisted that you confront the reality of death from an early age. Did that have a positive effect on you, do you think?
Well, his time, you know, the time of my childhood and his time in Haiti was such, you know, was still the dictatorship. And I think for him, the church, you know, through the church, I was able to observe very early on, you know, births and through baptism and such, and marriages and death. And so you could, I mean, one thing about this type of religion is that you could witness all these cycles of life go by, especially from a very close place, being part of the minister's family.
And as you said, it was during the dictatorship, the Duvalier dictatorship, where I'm sure there were a lot of people who were dying almost publicly.
Oh, yes.
It was an awful time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew, for example, about you know, even a little bit, I was much younger, but we knew the legacy of the public executions in which school children were brought to watch executions. And neighbors who one day might be here and one day might have disappeared. So death was really part of our lives. And there was no credible way to protect the child from it, you know, from the difficulties of life. And my uncle didn't try to do that either, because I think he just knew the value of that, of also knowing how to deal with death when it surrounds you and on so many occasions.
This memoir shares something in common with your fiction, because you often write about the way people's personal lives intersect with history. And I was wondering if that's why you chose to interweave the sad stories of your uncle and your father with the story of your pregnancy.
Well, the thing is that these things, I mean, were revealed to me at the same time. You know, the fact that I was pregnant and the fact that my father was dying.
Well, there's a real contrast there.
Absolutely. I mean, they became one in this sort of this startling way. So I didn't have the luxury of knowing I was going to have a child without knowing that my father was dying, or you know, or the only having the sadness of knowing that my father was dying. So I think they became weaved in that. A great concern of the pregnancy was that my father get to meet my daughter. And so eventually they got to meet, and which created a kind of, you know, cycle that was fulfilling, I think, to him in the end, and that certainly brought some joy to the great sadness of his passing.
But you knew that he was going to die, but you didn't know your uncle was going to die. How did your father die?
My father was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis after many months of being out of breath and having trouble. And he had a very long and prolonged and very difficult death, but at the same time really taught us how to deal with that death. We had many extraordinary conversations, and I had a sense when my father died that there was nothing we had not said to one another that we wanted to say. But my uncle was very suddenly, his death was very different in that it was a sudden and brutal death.
Although he'd also had a kind of a long death of another sort, because he'd had throat cancer and an operation, and he could not talk for many years, and only learned not long before he died that he could have an operation where he could have a voice box and regain speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, he regained speech maybe 5 or 6 years after the operation. So he was able to, through his 60s and 70s, use the voice box to preach and to speak. And I think it did prolong his life, his ability to, you know, return to the pulpit, even with a voice box. And he was grateful for that, and it allowed him to continue his work. So the cancer in his stage was an obstacle, but it's something that he was able to overcome.
My guest is Edwige Danticat, whose latest book is a memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. It's published by Knopf, and you've said that this is more than a book for you. It's a cause. Because of the awfulness of the circumstances of your uncle's death?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like it's a way that to tell one story, and it, you know, that echoes so many other stories because of, you know, the treatment of people like my uncle, especially Haitian asylum seekers, and immigration, the treatment of sick people in immigration custody. All of those things are things that before it happened to me, I didn't know much about, and I'm pretty, you know, knowledgeable about these things. So I think it's also beyond telling a story, beyond honoring their memory, I hope it's something that's going to also allow people to get a hint, a view to an openness into these types of issues.
You weren't a witness to the circumstances of his death and his arrival at Miami International Airport. These are things that you had to investigate almost as a reporter.
Mm-hmm, because others were, and there was an investigation that was done by the Department of Homeland Security. And once the investigation was done, the conclusion was that no one did anything wrong. But what they gifted me with that investigation was all these papers and the interviews. So those people who were there, who were witnesses and had spoken through the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to get these documents, which allowed me to tell that part of the story.
Do you think that anyone reading this book will feel that the Department of Homeland Security is right when it says that they didn't do anything wrong?
Well, I think some might. I can't predict that, but this is why I wrote that part of the book in the way that I did, basically.
In a very spare prose.
Yeah, and presenting the facts as they were told to me, because in the end, I was on a great quest for answers. I wanted to know what my uncle's last moments were like, and so I presented the way, sort of in the most objective way that I can, and leave everyone or anyone to come to his or her own conclusion about it.
It's almost like a film documentary.
Yeah, because I think when you lose someone in that way, you know, there is there's such a great desire to know, first of all, but also to document, because, like, I felt like my uncle died in such a, you know, perhaps if they hadn't known him, that's the thing you sort of tell yourself, and maybe it's an illusion, but, like, maybe if they had known him, maybe if they had known that he was a father, he was an uncle, that he was important to some people, maybe he might have been treated differently. And that's what I hope happens for the next person who comes before someone like that, that they will see past what they think they see to an individual, a person.
They just accused him of faking to get into the country?
Yeah, I mean, he's 81 years old and vomiting and at his credible fear airing, and he was accused of faking by the medic who saw him. And he was accused of faking because I guess they they lumped him, and there's like, you know, in a way that, you know, the Haitian asylum seekers in Miami especially are treated a certain way, and his treatment just followed in line with that kind of treatment.
It's been government policy for a long time to treat Haitian asylum seekers as people who are really just not people who are escaping something awful, but rather people who just want to get better jobs or take advantage of what the United States has to offer.
Well, yeah, and if you live in Miami, especially where I live, there's a very glaring disparity between the way Cuban asylum seekers are treated and Haitian asylum seekers are treated. And I feel like, you know, my uncle, probably the most exceptional thing about my uncle's case is how unexceptional it is that so many people have had that treatment, and maybe they might have died not have died in the custody of immigration officials, but have died in other ways.
You're an American citizen, a mm-hmm. U.S. citizen. Does this make you feel a little less happy about your adopted country?
Well, it's, I think, you know, even before I was an American citizen, I think one's relationship, if you're Haitian or Haitian of my stripe, your relationship with the United States is always nuanced and complicated because, you know, the United States, there's the occupations and interventions of Haiti. So I am, you know, I am a nuanced kind of American citizen, and I understand the privileges that this country has allowed me, but I understand also the sacrifices, the extraordinary sacrifices that my family has made for that privilege. So it's a very, you know, it's a nuanced, it's a complicated relationship.
Your father left when you were very young, and then your mother left, leaving you back in Port-au-Prince. They were in Flatbush, and he bought you a typewriter. Do you think he had a premonition that you might become a writer, or do you think that was a factor in your becoming a writer?
Well, when I was in Haiti and my father was here, I would write him letters all the time asking for a typewriter because my uncle had wanted one, and I just thought it was it would have been a cool thing to have to type those letters that we were always writing to each other. But it feels, you know, it feels prescient. I was like such a great gift to have had the typewriter, but he gave it to me basically because I had awful handwriting.
And he really wanted to know what was going on with
you.
Yeah,
he's like, what is she writing? My brothers, they all still see, no one can read my handwriting.
Aren't you also collaborating with Jonathan Demme, the filmmaker who, among the story films over the years, has also made a number of documentaries about Haiti?
Yeah, we worked together on a documentary called The Agronomist about a mutual friend of ours, an extraordinary radio journalist named Jean-Dominique, about his assassination in Haiti.
Jean-Dominique was on the show, and his widow mm-hmm. was on the show with Jonathan Demme after he was killed.
Yeah, when the film came out. And we've worked on other things around Haiti because Jonathan is a great friend of Haiti.
Would it be possible to make a film on this sort of thing? Because this is relevant to an American audience.
I don't know. It was hard enough to to write it, and I'm still at that point where it's just I'm still in the sort of page element of it. But we'll have to see.
When you look at the situation in Haiti, do you ever despair? Because there have been a few attempts to reform the economy and to turn the country around, but they don't seem to have much impact. The country's been in such a terrible condition for so long.
I think like all Haitians, maybe I have moments of despair, but when you think about, you know, family and loved ones that you have there and the efforts that they're making daily, you know, that has to bounce you back from that despair. And slowly, you know, now, I mean, I judge my idea of what's going on in Haiti from friends and family who live there. And they say that there's some, there's some amelioration there right now. But, you know, Haiti, I think it has to be given a real chance, and that the people who just hop in and intervene and just remove people and put people in, I mean, they have to start thinking about what people want and allow people to allow this country to really have a chance as opposed to being always putting out fires.
Now that you've written a work of nonfiction, you'll think there'll be more?
There might be more, but probably the next thing I'll return to fiction in the next thing I do.
Edwige Dantegat's latest book is a memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. It's from Knopf. Thank you so much for being back with us.
Thank you very much for having me again.
And a reminder that Edgewidge will be giving a talk tonight at the 92nd Street Y at 8 o'clock. You can find out more information about tickets on our show page at wnyc.org. She'll actually be there with our next guest, Zakes Mda, so stay tuned for that.